From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly podcast from ACC.org. I've chosen three articles to review for you this morning, recording this on August 3rd. One of them looks at TAVR for bicuspid versus tricuspid valve. Another looks at the use of loop diuretics on discharge in patients with heart failure. And then the last one looks at a very interesting group of patients, heart failure with recovered left ventricular ejection fraction, something that we deal with quite a bit, and there's not a lot to guide us. So let's get started. The first paper is looking at TAVR in tricuspid versus bicuspid valve. It's an analysis of the STS-ACC-TVT registry, and it's a wonderfully done analysis. It's retrospective propensity-matched analysis that uses logistic regression to ask the question, what are the 30-day and one-year mortality rates, stroke, and other procedure-specific outcomes in TAVR for bicuspid versus tricuspid valve disease? Obviously, also looks at AI, bleeding, pacemaker implantation. And in the registry, they found roughly 27,000 patients who had a TAVR with a self-expanding valve between July 15th of 2015 and September of 2018. And the unadjusted comparison suggested that the bicuspid valve patients were a little younger, 73 years versus 81, and more frequently male, 55% versus 47%. And they had a lower STS predicted risk of mortality. They had a propensity match of about 929 pairs, which allowed them to do fairly sophisticated multivariable modeling. So there's no difference in mortality in TAVR for bicuspid versus tricuspid valve at 30 days, both in the range of 2%, or at 1 year, both around 10%. And the stroke rate was similar, around 3%. Life-threatening bleeding, pacemaker implantation, they were all the same. The bicuspid valve group, almost 1% needed a reintervention at 30 days. And at 1 year, about 2% needed a reintervention compared to much lower rates in the tricuspid group. And the big question, of course, we always ask is what about moderate or severe AI after a TAVR in a bicuspid valve? And it was different, 5.6% of the bicuspid group versus 2.1% in the tricuspid group. But notable in the analysis, the newer generation valves appear to have a lower incidence of this. So the authors concluded that a self-expanding prosthesis can be performed safely and effectively in patients with bicuspid valve disease, and the outcomes overall are comparable, perhaps with the one exception still being this aortic valve insufficiency. Now, clearly, these were very carefully selected individuals. In fact, bicuspid valve composes just 3% of the registry. And of course, typically what would happen is that if there's a more oval orifice or a bulky and asymmetric leaflet calcification or unusual coronary anatomy or aortopathy, those patients are getting open surgery. But with those caveats, it does appear that the method of TAVR has generally good outcomes in patients with bicuspid valve disease when carefully selected, as in this particular analysis. And it does then represent a reasonable option. Now, remember, these are older patients, 72 years. What we do with young patients, 50 years, who are trying to get through life with a limited number of operations, that's a different story, and certainly we need more data. The second article I wanted to talk about was a paper in JACC that looked at loop diuretic prescription and 30-day outcomes in older patients with heart failure. This is an analysis from the Optimized Heart Failure Registry, which had a huge enrollment of over 48,000 patients. And this study looked at about 8,000 patients who were hospitalized for heart failure and they were not on diuretics prior to their admission, and then asked the question if they got new discharge on loop diuretics versus not. In the analysis, there were about 4,400 patients, average age 78, 54% were women, 11% African American. Patients who were discharged on loop diuretics had a lower 30-day mortality, 4.9 versus 6.6%, but this did not persist at 60 days. The 30-day rehospitalization rate was lower in patients discharged on loop diuretics, 6.2% versus 7.7%. But again, this did not persist at 60 days. And so they concluded that if you were discharged on a loop diuretic and you had been not on a diuretic prior to your heart failure admission, that there appeared to be some benefit at 30 days, but not at 60 days. This is probably complicated. For example, if you got put on a loop diuretic in the hospital and developed renal insufficiency, then you might not have been discharged on a loop diuretic because the renal function was still recalibrating. And so, you know, unlike our ability to block the neurohumeral system, which has a clear benefit on rehospitalization rates and mortality, the benefit of loop diuretics is primarily symptomatic. It's volume or congestion management. And this study really doesn't change my opinion about that. Patients who have ongoing evidence of congestion in the lungs or the legs with acceptable renal function and blood pressure may benefit from ongoing loop diuretics. Those who appear to be perfectly fine without them probably are just fine. The other thing that's interesting, of course, is the introduction of the SGLT2 inhibitors in heart failure patients. And this class of agents is going to start having a larger role in our therapy because it clearly has a significant benefit on cardiovascular outcomes. The last article I wanted to talk to you about was a really nice consensus statement from a JACC scientific expert panel. And it looked at this condition, heart failure with recovered left ventricular ejection fraction. And there's 10 points that I think are worth noting, as the journal scanner Salim Hayek pointed out. First of all, given the complexity and the heterogeneity of this particular population, HEF, recovered EF, there's no consensus on the definition or the diagnosis and management. This particular panel said, let's define it this way. First, document a LVEF less than 40% at baseline, combined with, second, a greater than 10% absolute improvement in EF, and a second EF measurement that is greater than 40%. The proportion of patients who have this is variable depending on the population you're studying, but it could be as many as 10 to 40%. Clearly, it's a distinct entity compared to HEF-REF and HEF-PEF, and generally it's thought that there's a less pathological myocardial steady state, and thus recovery of these patients is possible. And patients with HEF-recovered EF have a 50% decrease in hospitalization, and they have better survival compared to both HEF-PEF and HEF-REF. Now, the biology, of course, is variable. Could be ischemia, could be chemotherapeutic toxicity, could be alcohol, might be stress-induced cardiomyopathy, myocarditis, and so forth. It appears that female sex, a non-ischemic etiology, younger age, and a shorter duration of heart failure are associated with higher rates of reversal of LVE remodeling and LVEF recovery. Now, this is probably the most important point and the take-home point I would offer you. Discontinuation of medical therapy for HEF-recovered EF is associated with high rates of heart failure recurrence, greater than 30%. And the panel recommends not stopping goal-directed medical therapy in these groups. And this has come up in my practice, particularly with stress-induced cardiomyopathy. These patients should be seen every 6 months to a year, and their LV function should be monitored every 3 to 5 years. What to do about ICD? This is a very interesting question. The panel supported ICD generator change for most patients with HEF-recovered EF, even if the EF has come up and is above the current rate recommended in terms of EF. Also, the panel recommends continuing cardiac resynchronization treatment if it's been initiated. I thought it was a really nice consensus document, and I wanted to share it with you today. So we've covered three interesting topics: TAVR for bicuspid valve, loop diuretics in patients with heart failure, and finally, heart failure with recovered ejection fraction. I did not use COVID articles this week. We've been hitting that hard, and you can find all those articles on the ACC website, the COVID-19 Hub, which has just the latest information all the time. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I enjoy bringing this to you every week. I hope you stay safe, healthy, and I hope you have a good week. And I'll talk to you again next week. This is Kim Eagle. I'm out.